Current State for Tuesday. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore here on 90.5 WKAR. We discuss the state of the Lansing City budget later this hour. By a 5-3 vote last night, the City Council passed their version of a budget plan. Some of it Mayor Bernero is okay with, other parts of it he's not so okay with. So we will discuss where that stands with City Council member Brian Jeffries, who joins Angela Whitrock of M Live and me later this hour. A mayoral veto of the document that was passed last night is expected. And Council Member Jeffries voted for that. We also discussed the state of the health of the Great Lakes later this hour with Lana Pollock. But first, both chambers of the Michigan legislature have passed budgets for fiscal 2014, but neither includes funding to expand Medicaid to more of the roughly 400,000 state residents without health insurance. That decision is important because Medicaid expansion is a key component of the federal Affordable Care Act. Advocates of Medicaid expansion who have faced cancer will be in downtown Lansing today, hoping to change some legislators' minds. They're part of a group associated with one of our next guests. Shashiko Staples Miller is a senior staffer from the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network. Good morning, Shashiko.
Good morning.
And also joining us, arguing for the apparent majority against the expansion of Medicaid in Michigan, senior legislative analyst Jack McHugh of the Mackinac Center. Hi, Jack.
Hi, thanks.
There's an increasingly familiar list of reasons that proponents and opponents of Medicaid expansion cite to make their respective cases. Shashiko Staples Miller, supporters like yourself often make the case that no one can afford to be without health care insurance in 2013, that it would reduce expensive trips to emergency rooms, that expanding access to primary care means preventing disease and more costly procedures and reduce health care costs. We're familiar with all of those arguments. What would you add to those common justifications for expanding Medicaid?
I think you hit the nail on the head in talking about the high points of why expanding access to health care coverage for low-income state residents is important.
But can you go any deeper, though? Fill in some details?
Specifically for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, improved coverage means reduced incidence, preventing the disease from occurring, detecting it earlier, increased odds of survivorship, and those are at the heart of what ACS-CAN is focused on, reducing the incidence and mortality of cancer in this country, and specifically in the state of Michigan, in hopes that they take advantage of this opportunity.
It's that preventative piece that is so much a feature of cancer.
Without question.
Specifically.
Without question.
And Jack McHugh, what do you make of Shashiko's case here?
Well, there are several myths that are wrapped up in that. One is that it's not true that people on Medicaid use emergency rooms less frequently. In fact, the evidence shows that they use emergency rooms more frequently. Also, we recently had the results in from an Oregon study of Medicaid that was pretty close to a laboratory type of double-blind experiment. And while it's a bit of a Rashomon in terms of which side of the issue you're on depends on how you see the results of that, it is a fact that if Medicaid was a drug up for FDA approval based on the results of that study, it would be denied. In other words, the evidence was not there to support better health outcomes from Medicaid. And one more thing I would add is that there's a lot of evidence that that being on Medicaid actually results in worse health outcomes for many types of diseases for a lot of complex reasons, the point is, many of these things that we kind of take for granted and assumptions don't bear closer scrutiny.
The Oregon study was a setback for proponents of expanded Medicare coverage.
I wouldn't necessarily say that it was a setback. I think what the Oregon study did was it allowed us to look at one state example of the utilization of healthcare services in the Medicaid program, as that was part of the Oregon experience. And what that study did show, which is consistent with studies that we have conducted, is that individuals do utilize the services that are being made available to them. We reference a number of different studies that indicate that having healthcare coverage through Medicaid is a much better opportunity for individuals as compared to being uninsured. We're finding that, 2 to 1 women who are enrolled in Medicaid are getting breast cancer screenings much more frequently than those who are uninsured. The same thing with women getting cervical cancer screenings. Providing access to those individuals to get those necessary screenings, again, to detect the disease much earlier, and then also allow for treatment. And Michigan is one of the states where if a woman is screened through the breast and cervical cancer early detection program, she then qualifies for treatment through the Medicaid program. I think turning a blind eye to the fact that the alternative, which is no coverage, the alternative, which means that individuals are scared to even go to the doctor because they're afraid of the cost associated with getting a screening or getting a wellness visit or a checkup. I think it's a little bit short-sighted and naive to say that the alternative, lacking insurance, would be better than someone having coverage through the Medicaid program.
There is a commonsensical value to that argument here that I think, Jack McHugh, you're trying to make the case. There's something counterintuitive going on here, that expanding Medicaid to people, expanding health insurance coverage to people who don't have it, doesn't necessarily always pay the dividends. And that would seem to be for our listeners who are not familiar with the results of the Oregon study that we have pointed out. I mean, in a nutshell, I think we can agree some people interpreted the results of that study as saying that people with Medicaid access, their health outcomes were really not appreciably any better than the people without.
And I think one of the other limitations of the Oregon study is to look at that population and improved outcomes over 2 years. I think what you can do within those 2 years is take a look at the utilization, look at the types of services that have been provided to individuals. But for cancer patients, 2 years is not an adequate amount of time for them to go through their entire course of treatment. In many instances, women who've had a breast cancer diagnosis and they are on a tamoxifen regimen, oftentimes their treatment lasts up to 5 years. So I think, what would be important to do with that Oregon study is to look back a few more years from now to really look at whether outcomes changed.
Why can't we look at the results of the Oregon study as kind of an experimental thing, something we need to learn more about, Jack?
Well, if I may take a step back and look at the broader situation.
Please do.
There's a consensus in this country that we need to come up with a system that that allows everyone to access health care. And if you think that our current health care system provides good value for the money that we spend, then you're going to love the Medicaid expansion and the Obamacare regime because these essentially double down on the current system with all its skewed and perverse incentives, and frankly the very poor value that we get for what we pay. So the issue here with the Medicaid expansion for the state of Michigan for our legislature. It is broader than just these narrow questions of this disease or that disease. The issue is how can we best provide for a healthcare system that provides good value, that serves the people who need the healthcare, that's sustainable for the long term, and that's affordable and works for our population and our country as a whole. And the direction that we're heading is exactly the opposite. This is not there are solutions. There are better ways forward on this thing. There's proposals for tax credit voucher-like systems, for There are.
What are some of those? Are any of those on the table here in Michigan? Well, is the GOP Medicaid expansion plan, is that more? Are you able to support that more?
You know, it's hard to talk about the overall healthcare system in terms of just one state. Unfortunately, because of the structure of Obamacare, this is coming down to state by state decisions.
Yeah.
On these issues, but. You know, when you talk about the big picture, you have to look at the national policies, and there are absolutely have been, you know, in terms of political campaigns. I mean, John McCain ran on a platform of a very broad tax credit, which was a voucher, like health insurance type voucher. There are creative Medicaid programs underway in Louisiana and Florida, some pilot programs that try to replicate the market incentives for consumers to be, you know, prudent, good shoppers, and for providers to be efficiency maximizing entities that want to delight their customers rather than make them wait and put them through all the ringers that our current healthcare system does.
Shishiko, you've been nodding.
Yes.
Yes, as if in agreement with a lot of what Jack McHugh has been saying here. Tell us more.
Without question, states are being innovative in the way that they are approaching healthcare delivery for the low-income population, since we're talking about the Medicaid population or this newly eligible population. And I think you can definitely look at some of the delivery system reform that Governor Jindal has implemented in Florida. And interestingly, it's a similar approach that has been in place here in the state of Michigan for some years now, providing health care coverage to individuals through managed care plans. You've got over 90% of your Medicaid population today that's enrolled in a managed care plan. The state of Michigan has been taking a number of different steps in recent years to try to incentivize healthy behaviors with the individuals who are enrolled, but then also in holding the health plans accountable to providing quality health care coverage to them. And you can go to the Department of Community Health's website and look at HEDIS scores or the quality scores for the health plans, the 12 that you have operating currently in the Medicaid program in this state. And I think it's important to note that not only do you have health plans that are kind of homegrown, that are operating within the Medicaid program, that will allow for there to be greater accountability, additional measures that would be taken to make sure that the health plans are delivering on their promise, but that you've also got not just some of the local plans that are operating or the regional county-specific plans that are operating, but you've got some of the larger private market plans. You've got Blue Cross Blue Shield that's providing service or coverage to this portion of the population today. And so I think that you can definitely look at some of the reforms that have been in place in a number of different states and some of the innovative approaches that are being taken. If you look at Arkansas and their decision to request permission from the federal government to allow people to purchase health care coverage through the exchange and enroll in private plans, it's taking that approach, or it's looking at applying for an 1115 waiver or some other special permissions that have been part of the Medicaid program and available to states for years.
You referred to some perverse incentives earlier, Jack. Is anything of what Shishiko is sharing with us, would you consider any of those a perverse incentive?
Not necessarily, but there's less than meets the eye to some of them. For example,
what is one of the perverse incentives that you referred to earlier?
Well, in the big picture of the healthcare system, they come down to the source. You look at the source of them, which is the employer deductibility of health insurance provided to employees, which over the years this has created incentives to load up the coverage. So we're not really talking about insurance anymore. We're talking about prepaid health care. And the best way I've found to think about this is to imagine if you got your car insurance from your employer and you had real low deductibles and real low copays, you know, because, hey, it's tax deductible. Why not? And so that when you needed new tires, whatever tire shop you went to, you only had to pay a $10 or $20 or $50 copay. how hard would you shop for tires? How hard would those tire shops and those tire makers work to be innovative and more efficiency and more efficient? And that's the kind of situation that we've created unintentionally in our healthcare system, so that unlike other products where the value gets better and, you know, the prices go down and technology makes things get less costly instead of more costly, we've got just the opposite happening in healthcare. And it was unintended, but you look at how these policies have affected the industry and basically destroyed the any semblance of a real market system in healthcare. And, you know, what we have is what you get. And unfortunately, under this, you know, under Obamacare, we're going to get a lot more of it and spend a lot more money, but not fix the core problems that make us the reasons that we all hate our health, you know, the aspects of our healthcare system.
Medicaid expansion and universal coverage are at the very heart of the Affordable Care Act. There's been noticeably more concern lately, even among some backers, that the ACA faces a looming funding and implementation challenge. I'm wondering if, from your perspective, you wouldn't mind commenting. So, I mean, even some high-profile Democrats have used a train wreck analogy. Do these funding and implementation issues have you reconsidering, Shashiko Miller, any aspect of your own support?
No, we're not reconsidering, or we don't intend to roll back any of our support of this opportunity. We do realize that there are going to be implementation challenges. Mm-hmm. We're having our lobby day today, and I'm sure we're going to have some challenges with somebody showing up, and we're not going to have their registration information. No program and the implementation of it is without flaw, and this is a major shift in the way that healthcare coverage will be made available to individuals, and so there are going to be bumps in the road. We know that.
We're going to have to let it go there. I appreciate both of your time very much. Shashiko Staples Miller is with the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network. She and other proponents of expanding Medicaid in Michigan will be in downtown Lansing today. Also, big thanks to Jack McHugh of the Mackinac Center. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you.
And now it's time for another public poetry announcement.
Afternoon at McDowell by Jane Kenyon. On a windy summer day, the well-dressed trustees occupy the first row under the yellow and white striped canopy. Their drive for capital is over, and for a while this refuge is secure. Thin after your second surgery, you wear the gray summer suit we bought 8 years ago for momentous occasions in warm weather. My hands rest in my lap under the fine cotton shawl embroidered with mirrors that we bargained for last fall in Bombay, unaware of your sickness. The legs of our chairs poke holes in the lawn. The sun goes in and out of the grand clouds, making the air alive with golden light. And then, as if heaven's spirits had fallen, everything's somber again. After music and poetry, we walk to the car. I believe in the miracles of art, but what prodigy will keep you safe beside me, fumbling with the radio while you drive to find late innings of a Red Sox game? Afternoon at McDowell by Jane Kenyon. I'm David Clausen, and this public poetry announcement is brought to you by the Center for Poetry at Michigan State University's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities.
Thanks for joining us on Current State on 90.5 WKAR. In some parts of Michigan, it's harvest time. Farmers along Lake Michigan are starting to bring in their asparagus crop. The cherry harvest will follow by early July. Growers are confident this season will be better than 2012, when an early warm-up followed by a quick-killing frost destroyed much of the fruit crop. Last year's scenario also created another problem. Many of the migrant laborers who traditionally arrive here for seasonal work did not come to Michigan. Now, though the weather may be better, farmers fear a similar labor shortage could happen again this year. Current State's Kevin Lavery reports.
It's a postcard perfect spring morning in Oceana County, the self-proclaimed asparagus capital of the world. Just 2.5 miles inland from Lake Michigan, the wind whistles across Ryan Walsworth's farm. Walsworth's family has worked this land for 80 years. He's got 850 acres of asparagus, corn, beans, and grain. This part of the state is well known for its unique climate that's ideal for growing fruits and vegetables. Farmers appreciate the steady lake breezes that keep their fields less susceptible to frost, but Walsworth knows the wind can be either friend or foe.
We get wind almost all the time, except the other night when we needed it, when the freeze came.
On this day, Walsworth had scheduled his crews to come in at 7 a.m. to pick asparagus. But two nights earlier, a sudden cold snap paralyzed his stalks. Surveying his field, Walsworth guesses about 3/4 of it is frozen.
See how it's willowy here? And now it's eventually just gonna dry out and tip over as the water goes away in that. Because asparagus is like over 90% water.
The Mother's Day freeze forced Walsworth to call off his crews to let his crops soak up some sun. The situation was disturbingly reminiscent of 2012, when nature pounded the crops with such force that hundreds of migrant laborers steered clear of Michigan. Each year, Michigan relies on a steady influx of some 45,000 mostly Hispanic seasonal workers. It's a tradition that goes back generations. In some cases, entire families travel from state to state, seeking out the same well-paying employers. As an employer, it's Ryan Walsworth's job to ensure the paperwork is in order. It's an unscientific and often confusing process. Walsworth says farmers don't get much guidance about what to look for, only not to ask too many questions if the papers look real.
There's kind of two different sides of the story where the law says you only need to check this much documentation, but then there's another side that's enforcing laws that then is intimidating people into either not coming up here or not staying as long, or just, and some people stay because they're afraid to move around now.
That fear is what keeps thousands of migrant laborers originally from Mexico and Latin America from leaving the U.S. to spend time with their families and to return for work. Currently, the only legal means for hiring non-U.S. residents for farm jobs is the H-2A visa program, but it's rarely used in Michigan. Ryan Finlay is the National Legislative Counsel for the Michigan Farm Bureau.
It's extremely difficult. It's expensive. It opens farmers up often to litigation, and it's just a challenge for Michigan farmers to use the only foreign worker program that exists today, and that's H-2A. The legislation that's been introduced in Congress takes a huge step forward in coming to a resolution in that regard.
The proposal from the so-called Gang of Eight in the U.S. Senate would eventually phase out H-2A in favor of a modified work visa program. The last time Congress enacted significant immigration reform was in 1986. Ag producers in Michigan want to see a smooth guest worker program that protects them and their employees. Todd Fox scans his freight yard in Shelby, a few miles south of Ryan Walsworth's farm. His cherry and apple operation goes back 65 years. The Fox family has 3 farms within 30 miles of this spot and runs its own trucking line to ship its products and those of other farmers to processors. Baby food maker Gerber is one of Fox's biggest customers. The cherry harvest is still a couple of months off, but it's not too soon to pressure wash the tankers.
These hold about 9,000 pounds of cherries in each one of them, so you can see we hauled about 22 ton on a trailer. And these are all going to the Duncan Hines Pinnacle Food Plant in Fenville, Michigan. So that's one of our customers for tart cherries.
When I ask Todd Fox about last year's harvest, the exasperated look on his face says it all. At peak season, Fox usually employs about 100 migrant workers, but that didn't happen last year.
We did it all ourselves. It was the family that did the work, and we did not have any migrant laborers on the farm at all. They went other places to find work. I'm concerned that they won't be back to their old habits. That 1 year loss of relationships really matters. So we've lost some connections, and very nervous.
Like Walsworth, Fox is also mindful of legal entanglements. He's heard good things so far about the reform bill, and he hopes Congress will move quickly to pass it. But the debate is not over, and Fox says some of the rhetoric doesn't sit well with him and his peers.
some of the discussion was about making agriculture or employers in general the police for the immigration department, which scared a lot of farmers.
That would put a badge on your chest.
Yes, and with that in mind, you get worried about the other side and being sued for discrimination, and you know, it's a tightrope that we walk constantly.
State officials in Michigan acknowledge the flaws of the federal guest worker program. Belin Ledesma directs the Migrant, Immigrant, and Seasonal Workers Services Division of the Michigan Workforce Development Agency. She herself grew up in a migrant farm family. She says federal reform might help Michigan better market itself as a place that has strong resources for migrants and former migrants thinking about settling here to keep working in agriculture.
One of the things I keep looking at is how do we bring people back to the state? We don't do a good job in making this industry sexy to people. I think we need to start talking about food safety differently. We need to start talking about health differently. We need to really look at what agriculture does for us.
Mr. Chairman.
We're still on the Grassley amendment, Senator Grassley.
The immigration bill is now in the markup phase before the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's not clear when the package will move to the floor for a vote. But even if Congress moves swiftly, officials say relief won't arrive in time to prevent Michigan ag producers from facing a very tight labor market for the next couple of years. For Current State, I'm Kevin Labrie.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Connect with us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. Over the past 25 years, environmental protection measures have greatly improved the health of the Great Lakes. However, the region's waterways are facing new issues. According to the International Joint Commission's latest progress report, warmer temperatures are having a dramatic effect on the ecological health of the Great Lakes. Lana Pollack is the chairwoman of the U.S. delegation of the commission. She joins us today to discuss the past, present, and future of cleaning up the Great Lakes. Welcome, Lana.
Hello, and good morning.
Thank you for joining us. This report focuses on the Great Lakes health since 1987. Let's talk about some of the improvements first. What are some of the improvements we've seen over that period of time?
Well, the improvements go back actually even earlier to the 70s, but in the last decades, we've seen improvements in the intensity of chemical contamination in the waters and in the ecosystem as a whole. So that means the fish, the birds, and the fish that humans eat. Some of those pretty potent chemical contaminants have significantly diminished as a result of improved policies. Improved practices. We no longer just dump used chemicals and electronic used materials like we used to. That's made a difference.
What do the successes say about the importance of funding environmental projects?
Sometimes it's funding that does the trick and really makes the difference. And sometimes it's regulations that make the difference. And sometimes the regulations actually save public dollars at the end of the day. But the funding part of it, really the best part, was starting again in the 70s, and it really showed up in the 80s with improvements where the federal governments of both Canada and the United States, as well as some of the provincial government of Ontario and the states, put in a lot of money to build better wastewater treatment plants. When we first started looking at this in the 70s, it was clear that there was an enormous amount of waste going directly into the lake. So for the biological contamination, that was an improvement in that. That was investment of public dollars, made a big difference. Things that, you know, systems age, and we now need new investments because infrastructure doesn't just stay new as the decades roll on. But that was a case of money making a big difference in public health and in the health of the lakes, In the chemical contaminants, it's more the regulatory controls that have made a big difference.
Does your study suggest which projects really need focus here going into the future?
Yes, there are some obvious ones. One is that we saw a great improvement, and anybody who's been around in this area for very long knows that saw a big improvement in Lake Erie when the farming practices were changed and when the wastewater treatment plants were improved and when we outlawed the use of phosphates in the detergents that we use to wash our clothes. All of that made a difference in reducing the phosphates, which are the nutrients that load the lakes and create the opportunities for algal blooms, these big, slimy, green blooms, some of which are toxic, some of which are just plain messy and stinky. And that made a big difference. Now we're seeing the return of the algal blooms, and again, we need to take a look at, in fact, we need to do more than look at, we need to actually change farming practices. We also need to start looking at investing some money in new wastewater treatment plants or upgrades in that as well.
Do you think that climate change is playing a role in the increasing frequency of these algae blooms?
Yes, yes, indeed. The science indicates that they are. So, for instance, possibly the level of tolerance for certain kind of loading in cooler water wouldn't have quite the same impact as in the warmer waters. But that's still work that needs to be done with the science, which is another thing that costs a little money that has a big return, which is to say we need better, more consistent monitoring of what's going on. That's federal dollars, again, state dollars as well, provincial dollars as well, both in Canada and the United States, so we can fund the science, the monitoring, and the science for the analysis so we can understand what causes what. You can't do this on the cheap, but in the end of the day, of course, the benefits of the Great Lakes being healthy has huge economic returns.
I'm led to believe that in your report, one of the more interesting features of it is that it suggests there isn't that much we can do about climate change. Do I have that right?
Well, there is a lot we can do, but there's nothing we can do in the short term. We need to get both governments, both Canada and the United States, are really, really, really got their head in the sand in terms of the impacts, the true costs of climate change. So for our grandkids and great-grandkids, yes, we need federal policies and we need state policies that would reduce the amount of carbon we put in the air. For instance, the ballot initiative that failed in Michigan, Proposition 3 last November, would have greatly reduced the amount of carbon going into the atmosphere. Over the long term, multiply that in various places around the world, and you will make a difference. But in the short term, of course, that's not the way we're going to be able to handle it. So it's a matter of adapting to the climate that we have now while trying to prevent and actually reverse it for generations to come.
We're talking with Lana Pollack, who is with the U.S. representative on the International Joint Commission. We're talking about the health of the Great Lakes here. With regard to low lake levels, Lana, the commission recently sent a letter to the governments that suggest investigating ways to raise lake levels in the Great Lakes. You declined to endorse this report, as I understand it. Why was that?
I did. There was a lot of excellent science in the report. There was a lot that I agreed with. In fact, I agreed with most of what was in there. It was what was not in there that I objected to. Again, I think that people who are looking for quick fixes on changing lake levels are fooling themselves. You know, you just can't do it. It's not time for...
What are they calling for?
I'm sorry? What they called for, they called for a lot of good things. They called for the same kind of science and monitoring that I've just mentioned earlier in this conversation, but they also called for getting ready to adapt to different lake levels. That's good, too. What they didn't point out, what they also said is, okay, go ahead and study. They didn't call directly for putting a plug, so to speak, or a partial plug in the St. Clair River. There's a lot of talk about the amount of water that has the conveyance increased, the amount of water that has increased the flow through the St. Clair River due to historic dredging. The last dredging was in 1962, but it did lower the upper lake somewhat, and some people now want to reverse that. Well, you know, that's 50 years back. And I think it's foolish to be thinking that you can reverse the time clock in that way. What we really need to do is address climate change.
What role should dredging play?
Well, we've got to clarify here two different kinds of dredging, or dredging in different places. There's the dredging that people are talking about, and it is important, and will provide value this summer. For instance, if you dredge in the harbors, you can get your boats into the harbors, you can get shipping into the harbors. That kind of dredging, depending on what you're pulling up and where you're putting it down, if it's contaminated, you need to be careful. You need to be careful where you put it down. But that is something that we all support, in at least in principle, because we want to be able to help people access the lakes, their harbors, if all around the Great Lakes. The kind of dredging we're talking about here is dredging in the St. Clair River at the outflow of the of Lake Huron, and that there's pretty good agreement, at least that in general, that increase the flow of water through the St. Clair River, therefore lowering by some inches the water above it in Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, which is essentially one lake. Lake Huron, Michigan are just at the same level. So there are people who want to say, well, put something in the, some blockage, some degree of blockage, even if it's movable, into the St. Clair River. That, of course, would have, we don't know what impacts it would have. I mean, you could put a dam there, but, of course, that would be very, very, that would be a very dramatic change, and no one's actually calling for that. But you could put something there, people say, and this study did say, study it. I have to say my colleagues didn't go whole hog and, you know, just say, hey, build this thing tomorrow. If something were to be inserted into the river there, it would be, frankly, decades away before there would be an impact. I wanted to tell people there's no early fix for the low water levels that you're suffering, especially in Georgian Bay and the Les Chenaux Islands just east of the bridge. These people are really suffering low water levels. Other people are suffering it too, but there's no fix for it. We've got the climate change. We've lost the ice cover in the winter. We've got more evaporation. Unless we have huge rain increases or snow increases, we're going to be living with low water levels.
Lana Pollock is the chair of the U.S. delegation of the International Joint Commission, which advises the U.S. and Canada on issues with their shared waterways. Lana, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for your interest.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org on Current State every Tuesday. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Lansing City Councilmember Brian Jeffries joins us momentarily to update Current State on the Lansing City budget. First, let's briefly touch bases with MLive's Angela Whitrock on another story. The East Lansing City Council is expected to vote on a budget tonight as well. One part of the agenda in East Lansing involves a grant to increase Michigan Flyer bus service between East Lansing and Detroit Metro Airport, and not everyone likes that. Can you explain what's going on there?
Absolutely. Yeah, the federal government has these grants to help encourage more bus transportation, or more transportation really for low-income residents between cities, so they call them intercity. And Michigan Flyer applied for and received this grant from the federal government. It's about $550,000. And what the problem is now is that the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission, which has to rubber stamp all federal funds coming through the area, is maybe on the fence with this one. They've rejected a similar request before for Michigan Flyer, and due to opposition from the likes of the Capital Region International Airport Authority and Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero, they're all sort of on the fence about whether or not they'll actually go ahead and approve this disbursement of this grant that's already been approved by the federal government.
So they view it as a threat to revenue at the airport.
Correct.
Basically, it's that simple, that cut and dried?
Yep.
Okay. Well, let's invite Lansing City Council member Brian Jeffries in to help us deconstruct where the budget process is in Lansing. Welcome back, Brian.
Well, thank you, Mark. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Brian.
Mayor Bernero told some media last night to expect a veto of the plan the council passed last night, which you voted for. Is it clear to you what changes the mayor's plan, what changes to the mayor's plan that you made last night that is inviting a veto?
It's not clear. I mean, we've had some discussions with the administration. I think the big items on the budget and the changes that we made dealt with the Board of Water and Light and the funding for streetlights as well as our fire hydrants. The initial proposal from the mayor was to assess those against the residents. They have been being paid out of our general fund. And as we went through the budget process, we had a lot of community outreach through public hearings and attended a number of neighborhood meetings. And people are just telling us they've had enough. I mean, we've increased our taxes as high as we can. We've cut services. And to keep putting some of these expenses on our folks is, I mean, people are at their tipping point. And so we looked very hard at what we could do with this proposal to see if we could generate the funds through various budget cuts and through revenue or additional revenue, which we looked at in terms of increasing the return on equity or the payment in lieu of taxes from the Board of Water and Light to come up with the amount of money we needed to be able to use the general fund to continue those payments and not put the payments of those items on the back of our residents and businesses. So, you know, we've heard from the mayor that he supports some of that. I'm not sure if it's just the streetlight fee or if it was the fire hydrant or both. So I'm unclear about that. He has talked about the cold case investigator that we did cut. He had proposed a new position there. He's made definite comments about that. So he has until this Thursday at 5 o'clock to make his veto, and then we have 2 weeks to try to overturn any vetoes that he does. He has a line item veto authority, and anything that council would do would have to occur on the Monday, June 3rd meeting that we have. So that's kind of the timeline that we're looking at.
Can you talk a little bit about the sort of timing problems last night? It appeared mm-hmm. that you guys were working with what you thought was a balanced budget, and it seemed like maybe the vote would just be sort of a replay of what you did Friday, but suddenly you find out that's not quite the case. Can you sort of walk the listeners through that a
sure.
little bit?
Sure. All the pieces were in place. I mean, we weren't looking at the budget in terms of last night cutting things that we hadn't cut before, adding things that we didn't add before. What we had was new information brought to us late Monday afternoon that some of the numbers that we're relying on were incorrect. For example, we thought in our fleet fund we had an additional $250,000 that we had used to offset the general fund appropriation to that so we could use those monies for other things. As we found out, we didn't have the money in the fund. That was information brought to us from the administration Monday afternoon. There was an additional $300,000 that the administration had put in an amendment that they brought to us on Friday that we did not approve, but for some reason those additional funds were placed in the budget. So right when we were about ready to approve the budget, we were told by the administration that it didn't balance because of that $300,000. And we had to work back through that to show that we didn't do that. And eventually the numbers did play out in terms of what we had. But there were some hiccups along the way. All the pieces were there. We were just trying to put the right numbers to them.
We're talking with Lansing City Council member Brian Jeffries, along with MLive's Angela Whitrock. I want to get back to the BWL piece here, though. The mayor apparently does not quarrel with the plan to bump up BWL fees to the city in place of hiking the light and the hydrant fees on residents. This has been discussed in the past, and mm-hmm. it was more contentious in the past. Did it surprise you that he apparently doesn't have a problem with that, or?
Well, it's somewhat, and I think what we have to look at in terms of whether the mayor supports this or not is there's two pieces to it. There's the electric light portion of it, and then there's the water portion of it. I can see the mayor supporting the electric light using the increase to pay for that, but on the fire hydrant portion, I can see him vetoing part of that because that's something that he can, or that the Board of Water and Light can assess on our ratepayers, something the council or the city would not have to do. So I'm not sure he's in total agreement of all of that. But it was surprising because last year a number of us rolled out somewhat of a similar proposal. Yeah. We had asked to increase it an additional 1%. That's what's in the budget now. It's about 1.1% increase in the payment in lieu of taxes. And we suggested doing it over a five-year period of time, and at the same time increasing it by 0.25% every year. That would reduce our overall millage by a like amount in terms of what that would generate. Here, we're just increasing it, and we're going to put it into the general fund to offset any potential fee increases to our residents and businesses.
Now, once again, the council has recommended cutting three specific programs that come out of the mayor's office. The Sister Cities appropriation that helps fund, I think, trips, right, to the Sister City in Japan. And then the program officers for the Sister Cities program and the mayor's office of faith-based initiatives. Last year, you guys put through those cuts, and the mayor was pretty livid about that. Again, you've put through the cuts, and it's probably going to be in the veto list. What is it about these two offices that the council is just doesn't?
Well, I think with the Sister Cities program, we have, and this dates back, I think I came on council in 2002. We were dealing with this issue back then, and we had an appropriation at that point of about, I want to say, $80,000 to Sister Cities, and going through the cuts, we determined as a council and the administration at that point, I think it was Tony Benavides who was mayor at that point, agreed that what we would do is to eliminate over a four-year basis that appropriation, with the idea and understanding that the private sector should pick up that service or that payment for those services. And so we had put in place a reduction of $20,000 a year for 4 years, and that would have eliminated the city's appropriation for that that particular service. Some of it was cut, but not all of it, and I think we're still wrestling with that. We believe that, again, that's something that the private sector should pick up. Same way with the faith-based. There are a number, if you look around the state, there are a number of programs that have been initiated in other municipalities and other cities that these programs are funded by the private sector and by nonprofit entities. And, you know, looking at the financial health team and their recommendations, I mean, they pushed hard about recommending that we start looking outside. The city can't provide everything for everybody, and we have to start looking at programs that conceivably could be picked up, should be picked up by the private sector. So I think those are a couple of things that we looked at.
Other things that obviously were in the mayor's budget that were no longer in the council version of the budget last night, economic development funding, which he commented pretty forcefully about to the media last night, an IT position. That IT position, that is for what department?
Well, we have an IT department, but what was recommended from the financial health team was that the city seriously invest in our IT systems. That there's a belief that the more we increase that technology, there would be a reduction in cost to the city and increase in services to our residents. And one of the things that they recommended was to hire a professional IT person that would create a plan for the city. But the recommendation was also to work with the school district and have this person as a joint employee of the school district as well as the city. What council did is we didn't eliminate that position. We put in a control account some money that we thought if the city would sit down and negotiate with the Lansing School District, if they pay half, we pay half, it would probably take a half a year to negotiate that there would be enough in the budget to hire that person yet this year. So we were following the financial health team recommendation in that regard. We also did approve funding. There's the mayor requested $2 million for new IT software and hardware. We did approve the bond request for that. That's an appropriation of about $400,000 a year to pay for that debt service. I think there's a lot of support to do that within council. But again, this is a long-term investment. It's not just a single year. We have asked the administration for a clear plan in terms of what those costs are going to be in the out years, how that's going to save the city money, and how is that going to increase services to our residents. And we've not yet received that, but we're still moving down the road.
So we're aware that there's about a $1.4 million shortfall in the city's TIFA fund, which is basically pays the debt service on the courthouses, Cooley Law School Stadium, a few other things, and the TIFA fund can't make those payments any longer, or at least not in the next few years, it appears. So the city's picking up that tab, but you guys approved something kind of interesting last night as far as forcing TIFA to repay you. Can you talk a little bit about that and why?
We've got 60 seconds, by the way. Go for it.
Okay, what we did was we asked, and this was similar to what we did with a prior incident that was very similar when the city had to fall back on the full faith and credit and pay for some economic development activities. Basically, what we're saying to the TIFA, to the EDC, and to our Brownfield Authority, that when that happens, you're responsible for those costs. And we agreed to pay for that, but with the understanding that there would be a loan agreement which those monies would have to be repaid. We did not feel that the general fund dollars should be utilized for that purposes or for that purpose. They never have been. And so what we're trying to do is say, okay, we'll help you out, but as we've done in the past, you're going to have to repay that money. And additionally, we also looked at the revolving or at the reserve fund of the EDC. They have about $2.5 million, and we said take $400,000 out of that toward that as well. So that's how we tried to deal with it.
Lansing City Councilmember Brian Jeffries, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank
and Live's Angela Whitrock, a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, our Neighbors in Action segment looks at the gift of life. And the World Championship of the Odyssey of the Mind comes to the MSU campus. That and much more Wednesday on the show. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Yensi Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.